that we speak a bit about the idea of Musa, what it is, how it's connected to this time of year, what the Musa movement was exactly, what we should be doing about it, or how we should be applying those ideas. I'm going to assume a basic level that there may be some people present who are not entirely familiar with what the whole Musa movement and idea was and is. Is that correct? Others are not sure if they know or don't know. And try and explain a little bit of it at a basic level, as well as try maybe to include some examples to give us an actual tangible feel about what this idea is. Let's start like this. The general idea of the current of Musa, the movement, the energy that's known as the Musa movement within Jewish thinking, is the idea of character building. That means working on your personality as an explicit exercise, right? As opposed to just absorbing the ideas of good character and sort of coming across them by osmosis and through one's Torah learning in particular. There was an idea that became current in the last century, which is now an accepted stream or movement within the Torah world, that one should study these things explicitly and work on them explicitly. That's the general idea. I'll try and explain it in more depth, but that's the general idea. Let's start off by maybe, before we begin to actually take it apart, what is the connection, first of all, with this particular time of year? We've explained before, and we tried to discuss together in depth, the idea of the 49 steps that we go through between Pesach and Shavuos, which means that we understand that there's an opportunity to grow from Pesach, which is sort of a passive experience in a way, through to the human or even transcendent level of Shavuos by working steadily through 49 different stages. The difference between Pesach and what follows, we tried on one or two occasions to bring out in more detail. The difference is that Pesach is a one-time elevation. That means a person is rocketed, if you're sensitive to it. I'm sure there must be seats, you don't have to stand. The difference between that phase, which is a one-time spiritual elevation, and this, which is a gradual, many-step process, we tried to look at in detail that the first one is sort of a free experience that you can lock into and be elevated, whereas now you have the experience that means you have to work in small steps, making a kinyan, that means an acquisition on each step. There are no free gifts in this period. We try to point out that the period of Pesach is a free gift in that you get elevated if you want to without having to do any work. The problem is you have to pay the price afterwards of trying to make that a meaningful acquisition by retracing your steps, having been inspired and seeing what you could get to, through the 49 days that are 49 stages, really, of spiritual battle, let's say. The beautiful, I think there's a book called Sefer Azmanim. The author there is a beautiful marshal. He says that it's like Pesach and Sfira is like a father and son who are walking in a very dangerous place. And while they were walking in this very dangerous place, they came across a chest of treasure. So when they saw the treasure chest, the son wanted to start going through the jewels in detail to see what they had. And the father, who was wiser, said to him, let's take the chest and get out of this place, which is dangerous, and later, when we're safe, we can go through it in detail. And they say, that's the Pesach experience. You're at an unusual pitch of spiritual tension, but there's no time then to start going through what you've gained, and you'll lose it if you start taking it apart. You have to take it as a total experience. That experience of uplift, as we said before, like the beginning of a marriage or the beginning of a friendship or the beginning of any experience, is much more powerful than any other stage. But of course it's an illusion, because you actually haven't put effort into it yet, and it's only after years of working at that thing that you could get back to some of the inspiration that you might have felt in the beginning, but this time meaningfully, because you actually built it. That's the idea. So what we're going through, relative to the Pesach experience now, is the experience of trying to build ourselves in those detailed steps. And we tried on previous occasions to actually speak out a little bit, what are those steps? What are the 7 weeks, and why 7 times 7? Tonight is the third of the third day of the third week, which is the point of complete balance within complete balance. Very unusual, very unique time today, tonight and tomorrow. A person should strive for perfect harmony. Try and imbue the neshama with that force today because of special power that's available that you could use to do that. But it's only one of 49 different stages, each of which is critically important. The link, the chain, can't be built without every single link. Now, the idea of the Muslim movement was that this study, there should be an explicit study of these ideas. That means a person should explicitly take off time, put in time, to study each of these details in such a way that it becomes clear to you and becomes an inalienable part of your personality. Let's see if we can try and trace a little bit the history, just briefly without too much detail, of what exactly happened, how this came to be, what was the argument about it at the time, and what are we left with from that whole period. Let me say this, though, as an introduction, that we can't cover the subject of the history of this idea thoroughly tonight, and we certainly can't cover the whole of the depth of what it means tonight. And for that reason, you refer to some excellent books and tapes on the subject. Excellent tapes would be Rabbi Beryl Wine's series, where he deals with the Muslim movement in a very dramatic and unforgettable way, and some of the characters and personalities of the movement. And there are many good books. I would recommend a book called Sparks of Musa and a book called The Fire Within. I'm sure you can get them at the new Awesome Earth bookshop, where they'll probably give you a cup of coffee as well. Other places too. And you can pick up much more detail. And the whole essence of Musa is that it takes concentrated study. You can't just hear it once. You need to batter down the resistance and what's called the negias, the vested interest in the personality. It's a very hard work of having to batter away constantly and try to get these ideas to drive into the personality so that you actually acknowledge their truth. Recognizing their truth, as we discussed a little bit a week ago, 2 weeks ago, recognizing the truth is one thing, but letting it actually drive into your personality so you actually live that way is a completely different thing. The work of Musa was twofold. It was to recognize the truth of the need for character building and the details and anatomy of what character building is and where the difficulties are, and then the harder work of driving it home into the personality. The Ramchal wrote a wonderful book. This actually is his classic, which just happens to be here. This is his classic on, and glad to see well used, classic on the 10 stages of spiritual perfection leading up to complete transcendence, almost prophetic ability. In case you get carried away with it, you should know that most greats hold that we're not relevant to us anymore beyond the second or third chapter of the 10. But believe me, if you get to the second or third chapter of this, having internalized it, then that would be equivalent to much greater things. Of course, we study the whole work, but we have to know that there are limits in this generation, relatively speaking. He wrote a book called Das Tunis, which is devoted to the work, such a beautiful and wonderful subject. This whole idea of trying to touch on as many points as I can this evening, just by way of general introduction, is a book in which he deals with the problem of recognizing truth and then getting it into the personality. The way he puts it is that you have to recognize it, as it were, with the mind, but then you have to drive it into the heart. And actually, the book is a wonderful device. The book is phrased as a conversation between the mind and the heart. There's a male being called the mind and a female being called the heart, and he speaks to her all the time, and she asks him questions. And he teaches her, the two of them work out together, how to take the truths that can be recognized by the intellect and actually drive them into the neshama, into the heart, into the inner core of the emotions and deeper, so that a person actually becomes those things. That's the hard part. Let's try and trace the movement in very sketchy outline without going into best more than one or two of the characters who were involved and see exactly what happened. The way to begin the discussion is that the founder of the Muslim movement, the so-called founder of the Muslim movement, was known as Rabbi Saul Salanta from Salant, who lived in the last century. I think he was born in about 1810 and he died in 1883, something like that. He was a person who founded a new movement, but the important thing to understand for us is that there was nothing new about the movement at all. The only detail that you could call new is that he put it into a situation where people began to appreciate that you had to take it as something that had to be done explicitly. Until that time, the main object of Torah study and religious development, spiritual development, was definitely the result that took place in your personality, was the refinement, the spiritual change that happened to a person's personality. But the idea previously was that people were sensitive enough through living in a Torah environment, studying Torah the way it should be, that the effect happened automatically on your personality.
Or at least you got the message of how to work on yourself without having to sit down and study it explicitly. In fact, the beginning of the Muslim movement was a very interesting debate between the two greats of this particular issue, which was the Rasulullah Salat on the one hand and the Brisk school on the other hand, who felt that it was unnecessary to do this thing explicitly, and it was an admission of defeat to have to do it explicitly. Try to explain that. So let's understand the things, details one at a time. The first point is this, that there was nothing new about the essential idea of working on oneself as a more sensitive and refined human being. There's no question, everybody agrees, that's the underpinning, it's the basis of Torah. The point, anybody who would study Torah academically and not have any change in his personality, that would be considered completely invalid, exactly the opposite of what you should be doing. There's no question about that. And you'll see people are very sensitive to it. You'll often find people pick out and point fingers at certain so-called religious individuals because they seem to be doing the outer things correctly, but people are sensitive to the fact that they're not doing the inner things correctly. Of course, the important thing to be doing is the inner thing. You can exchange the uniform if necessary. The outer uniform if necessary if you've got the inner things right. But of course, the easy thing to do is to get the uniform right and not get the inner content. That's very, very easy, and that, in fact, is one of the prime targets of the Muslim movement, is to try and show up the inconsistency of those two worlds and make it clear, and then enable you to actually have the strength to put the two together. So when Rousseau came along and started teaching the idea that instead of just learning Torah and learning Gemara, we have to now sit down and actually study the subject of working on ourselves and do it explicitly and teach ourselves the principles, extract them from the Torah sources, teach them explicitly, and then go out and practice them in the world, and they used to practice them diligently to an unbelievable degree, there was objection on the part of a lot of Torah institutions and personalities who felt that that wasn't the traditional way, and if Jews had managed without doing it that way for so long, then it surely wasn't necessary. If we produced the greats that we produced in terms of human depth and sensitivity and refinement without having to do it explicitly, why do it explicitly? And basically the argument boiled down to an agreement, famous conversation is quoted between the Brisker Rav and the Rishon Salanter. The argument boiled down to the understanding that everybody agrees, the way Rousseau put it was, that previously we were able to do it automatically. That means you were able to learn Torah and you got it automatically. By the way, women used to get it just by absorbing it from their mothers. The tradition in Jewish life was that a man needed to sit in yeshiva and drum it into his head, but women had the sensitivity and to absorb it from their mothers, from the home, and Jewish mothers had the greatness to instill it in their daughters without needing a formal course of tuition in it. It's a remarkable thing. That's a tradition that goes back to the imams. And the famous beginning of the Beis Yaakov movement, the turn of the century, whenever it was that we now need a yeshiva system, as it were, for girls, for women, to be able to study the Torah that they need to study in the framework of yeshiva. And people hailed it as a great thing, but people who know that it in fact was an admission of defeat, in a sense. Because it means that no longer could the Jewish home provide that unadulterated power that a woman could absorb from her mother, going back to the beginning of the chain, that now we need a formal institution to do it, which is necessary, and it was done in response to the need, but not what the power had been before. Men have always needed to absorb it, both in that framework from parents and home, and also by the institution of yeshiva grappling with the Gemara and battling away at it with Torah until a change takes place in the mind and the personality. The point was that it was all made that the Jewish world came to a point, I'm not going to go over the details of this idea, I'm sure you're familiar with it, that we have been going down in each successive generation. You're probably familiar with that. It's called Yeridas HaDoros, that each era of generations, each group of generations in Jewish history has got further and further from the source, and therefore the voltage drops in an exponential way. We now reach a point where the spark of energy, the transmission of the idealism of Torah and its effect on the personality is now so faint that we have to start treating the patient, as it were, with intensive care. I mean, before the patient could absorb it, the person could absorb it in a healthy way. Now we have to feed it to him in the way that a sick person needs. Yes? In other words, he can't eat a healthy diet anymore. A normal healthy diet would be totally the way it always used to be learned and taught. Now the patient is too sick to absorb that diet. That means the person could sit and learn Torah. The world came to a situation where you could have a person studying Torah sincerely in a yeshiva environment with all the right elements and still not necessarily refine his personality to the required degree. So we saw the idea was that since the patient has become sick to that degree, you change the diet. If a person can't eat a normal diet, you might have to soften the diet so that he can nurse himself back to health. And the other side of the argument was that we agree that the patient is sick, but we feel that feeding him that kind of a diet will just lower the whole level to that stage and that'll be that. The patient will recover, but able only to eat liquids instead of being able to digest what he should be digesting. So let's rather try and strengthen him to be able to eat a normal diet. You follow? That was the argument. Do we strengthen the Jewish world to the point that they can eat a normal diet now and learn Torah the way it had to be and dispense with this whole idea of consciously working on our personalities? Or do we admit that we're not capable of doing that, and do we mash the diet, yes, and digest it and make it explicit and lower its voltage, as it were, so that it can be digested? The price you pay is that you admit a lower level. The price you pay on the other side is that the patient might not digest the diet. Are we together? The view that held sway, generally speaking, it was a massive discussion and debate for a lengthy, long period of time. The view that, generally speaking, won the day was that we are badly in need of intensive care and of highly modified diet. Therefore, most yeshivas in the world, not all, but most yeshivas today, do set aside time for Musa study as an explicit end in itself. In most yeshivas, it's 20 minutes a day or half an hour out of the whole curriculum, which is still a very small fraction, but it's enough to conscientize, if you want to use that word, to energize the circuits of awareness that this needs to be done. And of course, half an hour of study might well be enough to trigger the exercises that a person needs to do to go out and practice some of the Musa techniques. Rishol himself was a person who taught Musa in a most amazing way. He taught it explicitly as a teacher, and he taught it as a human being. The stories about him are legend, and you should definitely read books, many books about him, to pick up the sensitivity and the genius of the person involved. Let me start maybe with an example that most people don't know. Remarkable thing. Unbelievable thing. I was once discussing... He had an unbelievable effect on Lithuanian Jews. He worked in Germany also. Died there, in fact. But he had an unbelievable effect on Lithuanian Jews. This effect is closer to your heart than you may know. Once I was discussing the subject of South Africans with the great Rosh Hashiva in Eretz Yisrael, Simcha Weizmann, and I said to him, we were discussing the fact he was observing, the two of us were observing, what unusual people South Africans are. And I can say it. Right? And that is that we are still a community that has a remarkable degree of homogeneous ascribing, subscribing to Torah values. Yes, despite the fact, as I understand as well, it's a long discussion in its own right, but the fact remains, and people from all over the world will tell you how struck they are when they see the South African, we have contact with the South African Jewish community, you hear it in the Torah world, you hear it outside the Torah world, within the Jewish world, that they perceive South Africans as people who have a remarkable sensitivity to the question, to the idea of being a mensch. Yet you'll see it manifest itself in the fact that while this generation, my generation, one and two generations before us, let's say, may have come from Lithuania and may have dropped the idea of Torah observance, of mitzvah observance in its particular manifestation, and they may have dropped the idea of Torah learning as an end in itself, but dropping the idea of being a mensch, they certainly didn't do. Any South African who knows anything, if you think about it, you'll realize that your parents, and if not your parents, certainly your grandparents, were the kind of individuals who, while they probably were not observant in the formal sense, probably put all of us in the shade significantly in terms of human values, in terms of Jewish values. That means in terms of commitment to ideals, in terms of your word being your bond, in terms of the concept of integrity, the concept of responsibility, sacrifice for children, the fact that responsibility came first, in terms of certain elements of dignity and modesty. I mean, certain refinements. I mean, there's so many things. Person of that generation in business, for example, everybody knows. Jews of that generation, if a person said something, you didn't have to even shake hands. You know that if he said it, you knew if he said it, it wouldn't change. Today, a signature on a contract, irrelevant, because the person doesn't mean it when he says it or even signs it at all. There's no concept of loyalty or responsibility left anymore. That generation was based on those ideas. And we were discussing the subject that the South African Jewish community, and it's filtered down to this generation, unfortunately it's going rapidly, disappearing rapidly. The truth is that if you compare this generation of youth to one generation before, and you compare that to the one before it, you'll see an exponential and frightening drop in Jewish and human values in the Jewish community in this country, no question about it. The rate of intermarriage, the divorce rate, the way business dealings are done, sense of responsibility and dignity in the youth, mental stability, you'll see that these things are diving exponentially. And despite that, you'll see that young Jews of this generation are still relatively normal compared to many, I'm going to point out other places, but in many other places in the, they say, Western Hemisphere, where the youth, are hardly can hardly be considered to be normal, and certainly hardly can be considered to be Jewish. The rate of intermarriage in certain other places, although we are unfortunately accelerating in that issue in a disastrous fashion, still we don't come close to certain other places where things are much worse. And that was the gist of the conversation, and he said a remarkable thing to me that I'll never forget. He said, yes, and it's all due to Rabbi Saul. You hear that? Rabbi Saul Salanter, that great teacher, lived in the 1800s in Europe, to spend time in Lithuania, spend time in Vilna, and later moved to Germany, his teachings had such an impact. You hear this unbelievable thing? You have to be that great to be able to say it. He said that his influence on the world, one man, his influence, his teachings, had such an effect that the South African Jewish community, to this day, can boast the level of relative normality that we have, and certainly in a generation or two beyond before us, much more than normality, greatness in terms of commitment and all the things I mentioned. He attributed to the fact of what this man had put into us. And I understood afterwards what he meant. What he meant was, what did Yisrael do? He came to teach values of working on yourself as a human being, of being a mensch. The new thing that he put in, you follow? The new thing that he put into us, into our consciousness, was not sitting and learning Torah, which was the Jewish world had until then. He put in the concept of working on yourself explicitly to be a mensch. What happened in South Africa? The idea of learning Torah as an end in itself had dropped out, but being a mensch remained. And he attributed, yes, and anybody, just think back and think of your parents or grandparents speaking to you about the disdain that they had for people who didn't behave like a mensch. Right? And somebody who, just that, and everything that they meant with it, all the richness of association that they meant by such a thing, that you understood so richly and so well. Remarkable to think that at least in the mind of one genius, it was attributable to one particular individual. It's a remarkable thing. Other things that are not relevant now, that the South African Jewish community, particularly the homogeneous community, almost all of us Lithuanians, a lot of identity and uniformity between us, many other things also that go into the mix that could produce this result. Not tonight's subject. How did he teach it? He perceived from the age when he was a very young man, he perceived that this was the problem. That if people were left to their own devices to continue learning in a religious environment and learn Torah without being imbued specifically and fired up and inspired with the idea of working on yourself and taking as your ultimate project in life your own personality, if you didn't focus on that and make a goal of it, that everything you do should be explicitly fed in to what you becoming as a human being, and to perverting, if you want to use that word, to reforming the battle in your mind between the tendency of the negative side of your personality, Yetzer Hara, to overreach itself and to swamp the positive side, unless you redress that balance in a conscious fashion, he felt it wouldn't be done. And therefore he set about teaching these things in an explicit way, and himself, perhaps more eloquently than what he said, became a personality, was a personality, who taught these things in a remarkable way. There's unbelievable stories that are told about how he actually went about doing this. First of all, the many things that he taught have come down to us, classic things that he said, classic things, a genius of an ability to be able to put a fine touch to a situation in such a way that the right result would come out of it and no transgressions would take place. Let me give you an example. Just understand a little subtlety of wisdom and depth that a person can, with conscious effort and development, yes, that a person could reach. I'm trying to tell you a few stories that come into my head. Once it happened that people from Kovna came to Yisrael and they said to him the following thing. They said to him, the long and complicated, the details and the ramifications of the story are complex and interesting. Try and make it simple. He said, they told him that in Kovna there was a man who was a tzaddik nista. Tzaddik nista means a hidden tzaddik. A saintly individual of unbelievable level and abilities who was completely hidden and no one knew about him. How did they know? Because the people who reported the story said that they happened to be close to this man who was working as a menial laborer in a factory somewhere in Kovna. But as they got close, they heard that under his breath, he was rapidly reciting the Talmud Yerushalmi by heart. Okay? This man was revising, completely by heart, all of the Talmud Yerushalmi flawlessly. Now, you know that nobody even looks at Talmud Yerushalmi until they know the Talmud Bavli absolutely backwards. Nobody, you follow, the Talmud Bavli definitely is what we learn as a priority. So nobody would know the Talmud Yerushalmi by heart until he knew many, many other things by heart. And it's a remarkable achievement, unbelievable achievement. But they said that when they approached this man and asked him questions about himself, and he realized he'd been overheard, he denied it. He said he didn't know what they were talking about, and they must have made a mistake, and he was a simple laborer, and why were they bothering him? So they went to his stores, and they can't afford to let a man like this remain hidden. This man is pretending that he hasn't reached this great level, and actually must be one of the few of the generation. Now what did Rabbi Saul answer? Put yourself in his situation for a moment. You can't say Lashon Hara, right? You can't say something negative or insulting about anybody. On the other hand, you must say things that are true, and yet, you have to take into account this particular individual's feelings. You have to take into account the fact of his greatness, and that presumably if he's at that level, he must have some kind of reason for doing this. You follow? There are many things that you have to achieve when you're faced with such a question. Let me tell you his answer and see if you can identify what was going on. Rachel answered him like this. He said this: you say that there's a man in Kovno, the Tzadik Nisa, and you tell me the story about him. He said this: I very much doubt it. He's probably making a mistake. Probably it's a mistake. Probably you imagined it and the story's got out of proportion. It's a big mistake.
Why?
I'll tell you why. Because we're in a generation now where we can't afford to have anybody remain hidden. We're such a lowly generation. We so desperately need Torah teachers. This generation, its prime deficit, let's say, is enough people of Torah greatness who can actually teach. In fact, the Chazon Ish once said that you're not free not to teach Torah. You're no longer allowed to say that I can't teach Torah because who am I? The Chazon Ish said it would be like a soldier saying that he's lame and he's got an injured arm, how can he fight? When the fight is to the death, yes, and it's fight or die, then even the cripples have to get out on the battlefield to do their best. That's what the Chazon Ish said. So Rishol said the same thing. He said like this: that this generation we can't afford. If a person's that great, he would know that he can't remain hidden. You hear this? If he's as great as you say, he would know that he can't remain hidden. In other words, it's not possible for a man to be that great and still choose to remain hidden because the need is so great. But if he is so great and he is remaining hidden, he must know what he's doing. Leave him alone. Yeah, in one fell swoop, you hear what he did? He protected the man's cover. He took the heat off him. He said true. He taught a fantastic Torah principle. You hear what's going on without saying anything negative about anybody? Well, that's a challenge. Most people, as you're quite aware, only open their mouth to change feet, as they say. And I stand the degree of foresight and control that goes into such a thing. He was famous for teaching the priority of putting people first in an environment where you usually tend to think the other way around. For example, he used to say that how should you be careful when you put on your talus? You know, when you put your talus on in the morning, you're supposed to put it over your head, then you wrap all four corners and you fling them over your shoulder as you make the brocha, and then you put your spoon. So Yisrael used to speak sharply about people who would do this, and while they're busy doing this, they're flicking someone in the eye, yes, who's standing behind them, in shul, with the threads of their talus, he can't see for the rest of the day. So the person thinks that he's very big tzaddik, you see the way he's doing this whole elaborate thing, meantime he's behaving in a way that's a degradation of what he is as a human being. But the thing is, people aren't sensitive to those things. And he was famous for that kind of thing. It happened once on Pesach, that they came to Israel just before Pesach when they were baking matzahs. And you know, matzah baking, we discussed it a little bit a few weeks ago, the idea of matzah and the urgency of baking it in the required amount of time. There was the problem of how to bake the matzahs in such a way that all the details would be observed correctly, and it's a very tense time. If you've ever been in the yeshiva, used to have the privilege, the yeshiva used to take over a bakery. We used to go into Meir Shaarim and take over the whole bakery and bake matzah. It's the most amazing experience. But it's done in a spirit of unbelievable, larger-than-life reality, because you have to move from the beginning of the process at one end of the bakery until the matzah is baked must be less than 18 minutes. So the water and flour have to be mixed and kneaded, and all the rollers... it's an amazing process that happens in absolute concert, and everybody's saying the shame matzah is mitzvah, and you have to keep your intention that it's for the shame, that it's for the sake of matzah as a mitzvah. It's a remarkable thing that has to be done with great speed and alacrity. So people gear up for it, and so they came to Yisrael and they said, teach us, Rebbe, what should we be careful of, right? What exactly should we focus on? How should we be careful when we go about to undertake this matter? They were listening for the great. So he said to them, the thing you should be very careful of is don't forget that part of the process, in that bakery yard, there's a widow who's a sensitive woman. Don't rush her. Yeah, that's what you should be thinking of. Because if you bake the matzahs and you put all these idurim into it, it'll all be fine. And a woman will be broken hearted because you insulted her. Because she isn't fast enough, the matzahs aren't worth it. You see, the thing is that not only is the sensitivity and the chiddush, but of course we try to think the other way. We always think the wrong way around. You know, as they say, we think of our own gashmias and somebody else's ruchnias. You know, that's the tendency. The Yetzer Hara tends always to invert what you should be thinking. We think of our own gashmias, our own physicality. And we're very concerned about our own comfort physically, and very concerned that everybody else should do right spiritually. They should live up to their spiritual obligations. But of course, that's not the way it is. The Muslim view is that you worry about your own spirituality, and you worry about his gashmis, you make him comfortable. You worry about that person and take care of his physical needs, and you worry about your own spiritual responsibilities. But of course, we don't do it that way. There are many, many versions of it, the Bale Musa always pointing out. There's a whole movement that developed the style of saying these things and making them explicit so Jewish people could become sensitive. They also point out that We do everything in reverse. Another example would be, we compare ourselves always to the wrong people. I'm trying to give you here some examples of the thinking of Musa, drawn out of the teachings while we study the subject of the personalities involved. They say that we always compare ourselves to other people. You know that? We always worry, and we judge our station by comparing ourselves. But how do we do it? when it comes to, do we compare ourselves to people who are above us in station or below us? It depends what. When it comes to physical things, you always compare yourself to somebody higher than you. That's not why you don't have as much as that person does. When it comes to spiritual greatness, you always think how much more you're superior to some individual who doesn't have as much as you do. But of course, Muslim would have you do it the other way around. When it comes to physicality, you should think how lucky you are to have more than the individuals who have less. That's what Muslim would want. And when it comes to spirituality, you should think of how much less you are than those who have more spiritually, and how you should aspire to be on that level. They're obvious, these things. But of course, the negative drive in your own mind switches the wires, and of course, you make a mess. And that's what the Muslim movement came, to sensitize people to those issues in such a way that you could actually begin to work on it explicitly. This idea, of course, you found, as I pointed out many times, it wasn't new to the Muslim movement. A person should understand that carefully. Anyone who learned Torah studiously always picked it up in a mystical fashion. Their personality became refined, and they found it explicitly. Whenever you studied things that had happened to deep greats of the previous generation, you saw examples of people refining themselves, working on themselves, reaching unbelievable levels of self-control, and of course that had its effect. The problem was that now we're on a level where we can read those things and still divorce ourselves from those ideas. People of greatness in this generation who may not hold themselves to be Musa exponents, but you'll see this idea time and again. And not only that, you'll see it as reflex activity. The object of Musa growth is to get to a situation where a person can refine his personality in such a way that it becomes part of your reflex activity. It's no good if it's part of your conscious activity, but in a tight spot you'll slip. It has to be so deeply imbued that even when you don't have time to think about it, it will be part of your personality. And it will imbue the personality totally. The person will be conscious. I heard from, my wife told me, she heard from Rabbi Tsarnaevsky, the daughter of Rav Scheinberg, that, just examples come to mind, that when it was in his, during his life, and Uncle Zinti is still around, one of the great Rosh Hashivas of this generation, when his granddaughter was getting married, so his daughter, the Rebbetzin, came to him, great Torah sage, to ask him what they should be very careful of under the chuppah. Again, a similar story. Under the chuppah is an incredibly electric moment. People should know what you daven for under the chuppah, especially, says your tefillahs are answered over there. It's like a Yom Kippur, your life starts again. Remarkable moment, what happens under the chuppah. And what happens there spiritually, what's happening in the electricity of the spiritual world, is indescribable. So to get every nuance of halakhic requirement correct, so they came to Rav Scheinberg and they said, what should we be careful about? This is the daughter asking her father about the granddaughter. What should we, when your granddaughter gets married, what should we be very careful about under the chuppah? You know, check that the witnesses are kosher, check that tzubah is all signed, you know, all halakhic details. He said, be careful not to spill the wine on her dress. Isn't that beautiful? It's a white wedding dress, it's a special day, that's what you should focus on. That's a remarkable, I mean, it's only normal. It's only normal, it's only human, but to have the greatness to focus, of course we don't do that. We focus on the details and of course we smash the human and internal dimension. By the way, the people most in need of the Musa, let's just mention this as an aside because relevant to us, is that the people who most in need of Musa and the ones who most misuse it are usually the newly involved young people who get involved in a more orthodox, more Torah-oriented way of life, who need this message powerfully and often get the wrong end of the thing. A classic example, we discussed this subject in detail on a separate occasion, and you can get the cassette of that discussion, which is not so funny, although it might sound funny, is that you have youngsters get involved in a more orthodox way of life, and what happens is it becomes so punctilious about the kashrus of the pots and pans, you see the plates and so forth in the kitchen, but the parents' feelings, in whose house they are busy living, are completely trampled. So what happens is, you're going for some questionable edge of a detail, yes, in your pots and pans, and the mitzvah deraisa, the positive Torah mitzvah of your parents' feelings, is something that's, it's very difficult to achieve balance, and some people never do, but that's the thing that has to be focused on. Of course, what will happen is you'll see that people like that, the irony of it is that most of us, happens to most of us, while you're getting involved, you sit and study Musa with such a fervor as if you're really becoming a tzaddik, and meantime what you're doing is becoming so unbalanced. How do you work to become a tzaddik? I've seen people in yeshiva, they do things where part of the Muslim movement was that a person should deny himself a certain amount of pleasure. Because it's good for self-control and it's good, you know, that develops you. What they forget is that extreme methods of denying yourself certain pleasure, the greats of the Muslim movement, some of them used to roll in the snow. They used to embarrass themselves terribly. They used to walk into an underwear shop and ask to buy a piano, for example. And they used to have to do it repeatedly. And they did that to break their egos. They put themselves to shame. I'll try and tell you a bit more about it. But the thing to remember is that before you start doing those things, you have to be normal. Once you're already normal, once you've reached the level where you can be defined as sort of more or less normal, then you can become extreme. But if you're not normal and you're doing some extreme things, then of course you become more abnormal. And all of us have seen examples. I'll never forget the time when I was a newly qualified doctor, and I happened to be in Jerusalem, and I walked into the canteen in Osama Yeshiva, and there at the back I saw a young country comes from, it's not that relevant, but happened to be America. And there he was sitting at the back of the canteen. He'd been in yeshiva for 3 weeks, okay? He was traveling, he was, I think, meditating in the Sinai or something, and in an eastern thing. And then he happened to go, and he ended up in yeshiva, and he's twigged onto Yiddishkeit, and that was for him, and now he was working on himself. And as I walked in, I saw him eating lunch, and he was green. So I rushed over to ask him, to try and resuscitate him, see what it is. He told me, no, it's okay, he's eating his lunch without chewing it, because he doesn't want to get pleasure out of the world, okay? He's swallowing the food without chewing it. He read in some Hasidic Musa work that there were great rabbis. There were great rabbis in the early days of the Hasidic movement who put themselves through incredible trials and ordeals in order not to experience any pleasure from the world. But they were really superhuman people. The challenge was, after they achieved the level of being normal, they were able to work on themselves in abnormal, supernatural ways. The Nevadok school, for example, the Nevadok school of Musa, went to unbelievable lengths. Again, I'm warning you, I'm making it explicit that most of these things are not relevant to us. We have to do this in such a diluted fashion that we might be able to absorb some of it. If we do it in an undiluted fashion, we'll look bizarre. The Nevadok school used to do things that were extreme to break down their egos and their personalities. They would drive themselves to tears. There were people from that yeshiva and that school of yeshivas. They used to stay up all night repeating one sentence over another. There were people who saw grace of that movement. Stay up all night saying to themselves, I'm nothing, I'm nothing, I'm nothing, I'm nothing, again and again and again and again, with tears and tears and tears for hours and hours and hours to try to drive into the... And these were people who were not nothing. These were people already you could say were something. People who were giving their lives to the entire, people whose level of self-control was unbelievable. But that was the ethic, that was the ideal. There was a sensitivity to making these things real and to trying to drive these messages into the heart of the personality. It's very hard to describe, because when we describe these things, we get a picture of people who are completely abnormal. If you've ever had the privilege to meet anyone of that generation, and you get to feel the intense depth and stability and normality of the person, you picture those people doing these seemingly strange things, it's a completely different sort of a picture. In the Slovakia school, for example, the Slovakia yeshiva, they used to have what was called a bursa. A bursa means a stock exchange. The way they had a stock exchange, there wasn't any money for food, never mind for stocks and shares. The stock exchange there was spiritual. What they did was give each other musa. They would sit in a circle and give each other musa. That means they would say openly to each other what was wrong with each other. Yes? They would ask each other, and you have to know how to say these things. The Gemara says that there's no one in this generation who can give musa, who can give rebuke, and there's no one who can take it. The Gemara says in that generation, talking 1400 years ago, certainly there's no one in this generation, but they tried. They used to engage in relationships with each other where each one would tell the other one, but in the most pointed terms. You understand? The way we usually do this, the way we usually do this is we pretend to do it. How many times haven't I seen somebody who makes a big thing out of a little thing? But the big thing, he completely ignores. Somebody will come out and say, I want to tell you that 3 years ago, yes, you loaned me money, and I underpaid you by 2 cents, and I want you to know, here the 2 cents is, this person has got blood on his hands. The person's got blood on his hands, and he's fussy about the 2 cents. Why? Because he's blind to the blood on his hands, right? Because that's just too big an issue to admit. But you can afford to be a big tzaddik about the small things. I remember hearing from a mashgiach who was part of that whole world, the Talmud of Ravovis. Classic story, illustrated so beautifully. I heard it from him. It happened to him. Today he's a well-known mashgiach himself in Yerushalayim. It happened to him himself. What happened? When he was a young bochur in yeshiva, he wanted to develop. He sincerely wanted to grow. So he went to his rabbi, the great Ravovi. Today is one of the leading Musa exponents. He wrote his classic, he's called Alei Shur. If you have any access, if you have some Hebrew, you could try and study that work, unbelievable work of Kabbalistic insight into the personality expressed in purely external Musa terms. A very, very unbelievable work. If you can't, you get someone to learn it with you. When this man was a young man, he went to Rav Albi and he said, Rabbi, give me Musa. Do me a favor, I've got to grow. I sincerely mean it. I want to come and sit with you every 2 weeks, and I'll sit with you for an hour, and I'm begging you, please tell me what's wrong with you. You hear? I want you to tell me what's wrong with me so I can grow. So he got the shock of his life when Ravalbi said to him, you don't want Musa. You just want cover. You just want honor. You want to tell your friends, that's all. You want to tell your friends that you sat for an hour with Rosh Hashanah. Yes, and he gave you Musa. You don't want to learn. You don't want to work on your personality. You follow? You're a liar. You want to say to your friends, that you sat with the Rosh Hashiva and he honored you by giving you a mussar. He was so shattered that he couldn't face him. He couldn't face him. He slunk out. Now, I heard this from himself. David Weiss is his name. He was a Mashiach and Mashiach. He slunk out of the room and he couldn't face him. Every time Rabbi would come down the corridor in Yeshiva, he'd go another way. Finally, after a lengthy period of time, they unavoidably met. So when Rabbi saw him, he said, "Where have you been? Why didn't you come? 2 weeks after you came the first time, I was expecting you to come for your Musa, and you didn't come." So he said, "But Rabbi, you told me that I didn't want Musa. You told me that I was just lying. So he said, "You wanted it, didn't you? Didn't you want it? You asked me, didn't you?" Yeah. He didn't realize. You follow? He didn't realize he was being told, but he was told it so accurate, and he was told it hurt so bad, that he didn't realize that he was getting what he wanted. You follow? I mean, you hear that? That's the problem. The problem is the Yetzer is so slick and sly that it will mistake all the messages. It won't let you hear it. When you hear it, it'll misinterpret it. And that was the work of the Muslim movement was to. They used to sing it, for example. They used to take a Mesillas Yesharim, this book, Mesillas Yesharim. Mesillas Yesharim begins with the words that what are the obligations of a person in the world? What are a person's obligations? To serve Hashem, to do mitzvahs, to withstand trials. Those are the classic. Listen to this. You say that the foundation of character development, the Sheresh Avodah, and the root of all service of Hashem Atmima in perfection. Who she is Barei V'is Ames Etzel Adam is that a person should achieve total and absolute clarity. What is your obligation in the world? What are you supposed to be doing here? And so forth, and it goes on to explain it. So once a young student asked his Rebbe, said one of the greats of the, might have been a Ritzel, I'm not sure, he asked him, "Rebbe, why is it that we have to, why do people learn Musa with a song? Why do they sit over there, the Sinus Yesharim, and they sit for half an hour and they sing it out? Why do they do that?" So he answered him in the following thing. He just said two sentences. He read the sentence in like this. He said, "I suppose he does a Sheresh Avodah Tmimah, where she's Bavi's Omer Sheresh Avodah Tmimah." "Yes, any effect on you?" He said, "No." And then he said, "You say that Chassidus," and he started to cry. "Oy, oy, 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 but you say that, why that?" He said, "How?" And he sang it out in the tears of the Yom Kippur tune. And the Tommy started crying. The Tommy said, so he understood that to drive it into the personality, you need... Well, some of them in tears. Okay, vibrating and pulsating, okay, with the song of Musa, and listen closely to what you say, what you're hearing. Yes, you hear people sincerely working on themselves. Not only that, but they take it out of the yeshiva and they work on themselves. People who take on, even in this generation where they don't anymore roll in the snow or embarrass themselves in public, but they still do things. Many people in this generation, they still work on things, for example, what's called a Tanit Diburim. Tanit Diburim means a fast of words. But you don't speak for a while. Don't speak. I met many people in Yeshiva who within the base medrash, within the walls of the base medrash, wouldn't speak anything other than Torah. But if you went and asked them a question in the Gemara, they'd talk to you. Ask them something technical about what the time was or something. Don't speak to you. There are people who go into Tanis Diburi. That means Mama, say nothing. Say nothing at all. I had a Swadi Rebbe. Used to be in Johannesburg. I was in Manchester. A great man. He used to occasionally arrive in Yeshiva with a scarf around his neck. See, like he had a cold and a sore throat. And he wouldn't speak. He'd go up and ask him a question. For 3-4 days, he wouldn't say a word. To teach himself control in every word that comes out of your mouth. Got to be important as everything that goes in. Everything that comes out got to be as pure as everything that goes in. Rav Miller from Gateshead used to say that when he went to meet Rav Dessler the first time when he was a little boy, when he was a young boy, his father took him to what later, the man who later became his Rebbe, the great Rav Dessler, who in fact was a great grandson of Rav Yisrael Salanter. He once, when he was taken to meet him as a little boy, they walked in, Rav Dessler was sitting at the table, his father sat him down, and his father asked Rav Dessler, he wanted to ask him if the child could learn with him. He started asking Rav Dessler very simple questions. He asked him a very simple, straightforward, question, and Rav Dessler put his head in his hands, and he thought, and thought, and thought, and thought. After many, many minutes of thinking, he answered yes. And they asked him the next question, and after many, many minutes of thinking, he answered no. And he couldn't understand. He said he learned later, he said, that Rav Dessler was going through a period in his life when he was working on controlling every word that came out of his mouth, that there shouldn't be one excessive word, that every nuance of every word should be checked and controlled. And that's how he did it. He had to go through a period of overdoing it. And I think, and you'll find people who still are doing these. Honestly, Burim, one can be highly recommended. Okay? You don't have to, don't think that you just have to be normal. But honestly, Burim, even if you're abnormal, it's strongly suggested. A lot of many breakdowns in many things won't happen if you go, that's what happens. Marriage notwithstanding. Yisrael was famous, a very beautiful incident. Talk about these things all night. Very beautiful incident once happened when it was the Chofetz Chaim, great, great tzaddik of that generation. Chofetz Chaim wrote a book detailing the, which is, you should definitely study today, it's been translated, you can read the English version, I think it's called Guard Your Tongue, exactly how you should speak, what's allowed and what's not allowed. So there the Chofetz Chaim wrote a certain statement that if a person maligns someone else, let's say a person was speaking to somebody and they blackened the name of someone else, okay, Lashon Hara, Mechilas, then Lashon Hara. Now, they have to ask that person's forgiveness for blackening their name. So the Chofetz Chaim writes that you should do it before Yom Kippur, because if you haven't done it before Yom Kippur, how can you go into Yom Kippur without a clean slate? You need the forgiveness of that individual whom you harmed in order to enter Yom Kippur with a clean slate. And therefore you must go and ask his forgiveness. So Yisrael taught that it's wrong. He disagreed. He disagreed with the great Chofetz Chaim. He taught that it's wrong. You shouldn't do that. Why? Because listen to the logic. Because he says, if you go up to that individual who doesn't know that you insulted him, and to ask his forgiveness, you have to ask his forgiveness. To ask his forgiveness, you have to tell him what you did. So now he'll be anguished over it. He'll enter Yom Kippur anguished, knowing that somebody said those bad things about him in front of other people. And you may not have a clean slate on Yom Kippur by causing him anguish. You hear that? You never mind him. You go into Yom Kippur with the anguish, rather than you follow. What must you do? You must work incredibly to make up for the tarnished image that you caused of that person in the world. But never mind his forgiveness, you suffer the consequences. You hear this? What right have you got to a clean slate that he should be hurt? So when they told this to the Chofetz Chaim, when the Chofetz Chaim heard this, he said that he based it on Rabbeinu Yonah. There's one of the Rishonim, one of the great saints of the 12th century, whatever, who's on a cosmic level compared to us. He didn't say it on his own accord, he quoted it. So it came out that Rabbi Yisrael was arguing, Rabbi Yisrael Salanter was in fact arguing with the Rishon. Anybody knows how halacha works, you can't argue with somebody of that greatness. So when they wanted to resolve this difficulty, they asked Rav Aaron Kotler, the great Rosh Hashiva who founded basically Torah in America in the last generation. They asked him who was right, the Chofetz Chaim or Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. And his answer was, Rabbi Yisrael Tanahu Upalik. That's what he said. He's a Tana and he can argue. That means he's considered to be of such an early generation in his greatness that he can argue with the Chofetz Chaim. Now, if you understand the greatness, the awe in which they held these people. How did Yisrael die? How did he die? When he died in 1883, it was remarkable things. Before I tell you how he died, let me tell you one more thing about how he lived. In case you think that he took the easy way up. See, many people make a mistake. They think that Musa is easy. You learn Mesillas Yesharim, it's beautiful. You open Mesillas Yesharim, here you have a facing English translation. You read exactly what are your obligations in the world, and how you go through watchfulness, and zealousness, and purity, and how you go through all these levels. It's beautiful. Gemara is difficult. Gemara is hard work. To get that logic of Gemara into your head is an endless battle. Terribly difficult. It's actually the opposite. This is harder. But the point is, that's what people think. So they think that a person who specializes in Musa takes the easy way out. In fact, part of the early criticism of the Musa movement was that the people who were great in Musa, actually what they were doing was they were copping out and opting out of Torah greatness. Instead of reaching a level of tremendous depth in learning, and from that having the personality being imbued with greatness and sensitivity and be inspired, they thought that these people, and a story that happened once to Yisrael illustrates this beautifully, to show you how wrong they were and how he proved it. The well-known story also, you can also read it in many of the books about him, is that once in his early days, when he just began the idea of the Muslim, and the tremendous opposition, it was unorthodox and unprecedented, people felt it was a change, a break with tradition. So what happened was, once he went to give a halacha shiur, not Musa, he got up in the yeshiva to give a, I think it was in the Ramael's yeshiva, he got up to give a shiur in halacha, a learned discourse in Talmud with all its intricacy, and like as the custom is, he had published on the notice board a day or two before, he had published what's called the Maariv Makariv. In other words, the references that he'd been using, that he would be using in his work. You follow? So many references to the Rambam, and so many Gemaras, and so many quotes in the Shulchan Aruch. The whole list of detailed halachic references that he would be using to build this fantastic, he was known to be very great in halacha, he's a genius, that he would be building the Shira. Now there was such opposition to him, listen to the story, unbelievable. Anyone who knows anything about Gemara, anyone who's had their head in a Gemara and knows halacha will be able to appreciate the story. There was such opposition to the movement that some people who wished him ill changed the list. Okay? Just before the shir, or sometime before they changed the list, they put up a nonsensical list of references, okay? They took his list off the wall and they put up a list of haphazard references, quoting some isolated group, you follow me? Page so-and-so in this Gemara, of course, all you have is the page number, just the reference. You don't have the text in a reference, you just have the page number. Page this of this, page that of that, unconnected halachic references, a complete jumble. Anybody looked at that list and tried to look it up would find a total meaningless jumble of references.
This is what happened. He walked into the yeshiva. Now understand the story. Many, many witnesses to this. He walked in, and as he walked up to the bima to give his talk, he walked past the list and he saw it wasn't his list. So he paused. The story goes like this. He paused in front of the list for a few minutes. Some say 1 minute. The Rebbe, I heard it from someone who said he stayed there for a minute. Some say two, some say three. Now the point is, he stood there for a couple of minutes. He looked at the list without flinching. He went up to the podium and he gave a shir on those references. One subject, one halachi subject, based on those references. You don't understand. This means that they were unconnected, okay? But in his genius, he connected them, and he connected them from not having seen them. All you have on the list is the page number, okay? The page number in the first three words. You follow? But he was such a genius in halacha, never mind in Musa. He was such a genius in conventional Torah learning that he was able, just from our list of references, just by the numbers, page this, paragraph that in the Rambam, instantaneously to put together a sheer of genius on those subjects. And the people who know say that he wasn't standing there for 3 minutes. Listen carefully to this. The 3 minutes that he stood there, or the two or the one, were not 3 minutes spent in connecting the references in his mind. That was instantaneous. He stood there for 3 minutes battling with a question of whether it would be too prideful to do such a thing. That's all. You follow? Because to show his greatness in that way would be a demonstration of one's greatness. And one's humility should override one's greatness. So he shouldn't. And then he thought to himself, but they've done this to show that I don't know anything in learning. So maybe I should show my greatness in learning, you follow? To show that Musa's valid and is not a contradiction. And that battle raged within him for 3 minutes. And he finally decided he had to do it. Understand? People who follow exponents of the Muslim movement, when they teach this in so many ways, the same Mashgiach I mentioned to you once before, listen to the subtlety, listen to this. The person who came out of that school, well known. One of the Talmidim of another great and unbelievable exponent of this way of thinking, Rabbi Menachem Mendel Morgenstern, the Kotzke Rebbe. One of his Talmidim. Once when he was dying, the man was dying, the students stood around and they knew that this man was from a great school of Musa where people work on themselves. And that the last moments of a person's life are not free from the desire, from the attempt in such a great person's mind to work on himself. So they said, Rebbe, what's the Yetzirah saying to you now? They wanted to know, is your negative inclination still with you? What happens to it in the last seconds of a moment? They're quizzing him as he's dying. Yeah, that itself teaches you what's going on in it. So he said, sure, he's with me. They said, Rebbe, maybe he's left you now. Maybe the Yetzirah, you know, he gets weak at this moment. They could see his neshama slipping away. Understand this. Didn't stand around wringing their hands. They questioned him about the experience. So he said, he's very much with me, speaking to me all the time. So they said, Rebbe, what's he saying to you? So he said, he's telling me to say Shema and draw out the word Echad so that I can die with the Shema on my lips like Rebbe Akiva. Hear that? The Yetzirah is telling me, listen to this. He's in the last moment of, you know, if a person comes face to face with reality, okay, if a person ever has the pride drained out of him, it's when he faces that awesome transition between this and the next. And in that moment, what's happening? He's having a battle with his Yetzirah. He knows he's dying, and his pride is saying, die with pride. I mean, with false pride, you follow? Say Shema so you look like Rebbe Akiva. Yes, but he resisted. He didn't say it, although he would have loved to say it. But it's a temptation. A man wants to die saying Shema, but he resisted the temptation because he knew he was not saying it with pure motivation. He wasn't saying Shema because he wanted to die saying Shema. He wanted to die so that he wanted to say the Shema so that people would say that he died with Shema and he says, what a great man. And in order not to do it, he resisted it. You hear that? I heard this from a Mashgiach who said, after the end of the story, when we were all sitting there dumbstruck, he said, you see, so he failed anyway. Why did he tell them? Because what happened was, yeah, he showed them his greatness of self-control. You see, that he was blind to. Are you with me? No? Think about it. Some say he failed, some say he didn't fail. Doesn't matter. There are two versions of the story. The point is, that's the level. When Yisrael died, there's a story told by a very changed human being who was with him. He died alone for certain reasons. He was in Königsberg at the time, in the Jewish community over there. None of his family. He was not well, and he was, the last day of his life was approaching, and he was too weak to move, and it was the end. And the Jewish community, realizing his greatness, he was famous by them, although he was pathetically alone at that time, they wanted not to leave him alone. So they took someone in the community that should sit with this man. He should not be literally alone. Okay? So the man sat in the room as Rabbi Saul died. And afterwards he told the story like this, that it was the last night of his life, and his strength was slipping away. What did he talk about to this man? Listen carefully. What did he talk about in the last minutes and seconds of his life? This is what happened. The man saw that Rabbi Saul was dying, and he suddenly got an intense fear that he was going to be left alone with a corpse. So Rabbi Saul spent the last minutes and hours of his life winning over this man's confidence and speaking to him, and suddenly led the conversation into the subject of how no harm would come to anybody who would sit alone with a corpse. You hear that? The last conversation was that he used all his remaining strength to convince this individual that he shouldn't be frightened, and there'd be nothing to worry about, you follow, and he wouldn't come to any harm, yes, if he should find himself alone in a room with a corpse.
Whose?
His. A standard. And that's the conversation that he reported, and those were his last words. Imagine that a man of that level would have liked a few minutes to himself at that time, as he felt his life slipping away. Imagine he would have liked a few minutes, yes, to think of his own mortality and to put things right, a lot of things to think about at that time. No, he didn't do that. He sacrificed that experience, yes, to put another man's mind at ease, that he shouldn't have some unpleasant moments, yes, in that macabre setting. The legacy of the Muslim movement filtered out into all branches of Judaism. Hasidic movement filtered out into... I'll tell you a story. I'll tell you a story that illustrates the idea of the lengths that people went to when they absorbed these ideas and made it their life's work, their homework, their internal work. Well-known story about a Rebbe called Evzusha. Russia, great Rebbe. The students also were well known for working on themselves. It's a well known story. This is what happened. It was by Rav Zusha, just trying to pick a few examples to maybe try and inspire us a little bit with the idea of what it means to put oneself through, instead of seeking only the easy and the pleasurable, to put oneself through experiences that are the fire of refinement. 49 days, we're working on ourselves. Sphere now, very serious time, a dangerous and serious time. It's a time to work on ourselves. Rav Zusha once had a talmid. This student was an older man. He used to sit and learn in the base medrash of Rav Zusha. He was a penniless individual. And he had a daughter at home who needed to get married. But he had no money. He had no money to marry her, so he sat and learned. One day the Rebbe came, his Rebbe Rav Zusha came, and he gave him 400 rubles. 400 rubles was a fortune. It was enough to marry off his daughter in style. The Rebbe said, you take it and you do it. You do it. He took the money. He took a wagon. He hired a wagon, and he started heading for home, for the town in which he lived, in order to marry his daughter. On the way, this is what happened. Listen to the details, beautiful story. On the way, this is what happened. He passed through a town, and in the square of the town, as the horses was being watered and they were having a rest, he heard a commotion. What was the commotion? He went over and he saw the following scene. There was a kuppah set up there. There was the rabbi. There was a young bride. And there was a young groom. And the young person was refusing to go through with the ceremony. Why? Because the bride's mother, who was a widow, had promised him a certain amount of money as a dowry. And the money wasn't at hand. And he was refusing to marry the girl unless the money was there. Yes? How much was it? Happened to be 400 rubles. So, the woman said that it's at home, don't worry, you'll get it. No, he wouldn't go. So they sent somebody to the house. The person came back and said, the money's not there, it's been stolen. And the person refused, the girl fainted, the mother fainted. The people, there was a hysteria. People tried to push the person to go. It was terrible. So this Talmid, without a moment's hesitation, he stepped forward and he said, I found the money. What's the problem? I found the money. 400 rubles, that's exactly what I found. It's back in my hotel room. But before I go and fetch it, just to make sure that it's rightfully yours, I want you to tell me, in what denominations was the money? How many 50s, how many 10s? So the mother said, well, there were so many 50s and so many 10s over. So he said, we'll go and check. So he ran off around the corner. He didn't have any hotel room. He was just passing through that day. He ran off into the market and he changed his 400 rubles into those denominations so that no one would know that it wasn't the money that had been stolen. He arrived back and he said, well, you know, exactly as you said. Must have been yours. Here it is. Yes, and there was great rejoicing and so on. As he was about to hand it over, he said, but of course, I want payment. I can do this for nothing. I want payment for this. So the mother fainted and the daughter fainted. Because what you take money for a mitzvah? Hashavas Aveda, a mitzvah of the Torah. You give back lost property, take money for that? So So finally, they revived the mother, they revived the... Finally, they tried to persuade him that they weren't going to... So finally, he refused, point blank, wouldn't... So eventually the people said, listen, you get some people like this, maybe we should do it. Pay! How much do you want? You want 25 rubles. 25 rubles was a fortune. They started fainting again and collapsing. And they refused. They refused. That was absolute robbery, and they refused to do it. And they demanded that he come for a hearing in front of the Rav of the town, the rabbi of that town, and they schlepped him off in dignity to the rabbi of the town. And when the Rav heard the story that this man had found money in the right denominations, obviously these people's money, and he is demanding payment and a fortune for a mitzvah, of course he ruled against him. He ruled it's a Shabbos Abed, it's a mitzvah, you can't fall. He goes, no, we can't get paid for a mitzvah, give the money back. The man gave the money back, and he was hounded out of town in disgrace. Where did he go? He went back to Zusha. He didn't have any money left to marry off his daughter. He went back and he started saying anything to anybody. He sat down and started learning. 2 months later, Zusha himself, the Rebbe, was traveling through town. And he paid a courtesy call on the Rav of the town. When he visited the rabbi of the town, this Rav said to him, you know, Zusha, I'm very surprised at what happened here 2 months ago. Right? Of course, he knew something was afoot because he'd seen this man leave, and then shortly afterwards, immediately afterwards, they arrived back and said, I didn't ask him any questions. But he realized something had happened. He said, you know, I'm very surprised. One of your Hasidim was here, one of your Talmidim, and a most terrible thing happened. He found money that belonged to other people, and instead of giving it back voluntarily, as anybody would, he started demanding payment for the mitzvah. I mean, is that how you teach your Talmidim, you know? So Zusha realized immediately what had happened. And he went back, and he called this Talmid in front of him, and he said, listen, what exactly happened over there? Listen to this beautiful thing. I know what happened. I know there was money missing. And I know you stepped forward to offer your money. That's what I expect. Expect less than that. Of course, that's what I expect. I knew you'd do such a thing. That doesn't bother me. But what bothered me was that they told me that you asked for payment. You asked for payment for a mitzvah. What was going through your mind? And you had to be taken to the Rav of the town, and you had to be... So the Talmid, he had to speak about it now. His Rebbe knew about it. He said, this is what happened. I'll tell you what happened. Very simple. I heard the story, by the way, from Shalom Shvadron, the great Magidim of Yerushalayim. I was listening to the story with my brother-in-law. It's interesting. Listen well. This is what the Talmud said to his Rebbe. He said that, I was passing through the town, and when I heard this commotion, I went over and found out what was going on, and the 400 rubles was missing. Obviously, I was going to give the money. Wasn't a problem. I mean, that's what I've been trying to do. I've been working on myself. But you know what happened? An unbelievable thing. As I started to hand over the money, an unfamiliar little voice inside me started saying, "Why, you a tzaddik?" So I said, quiet. And I managed to squash him down, and I was going to do the money. And then, of course, I realized I couldn't give the money. I had to ask them what the nominations, because if they thought it was my money, it would be terrible. I don't want them to know that I did it. So I asked them what the... And as I said that, the voice said a bit louder this time, you are really a tzaddik. Not only are you going to give the 400 rubles, that's for your own daughter's wedding, an unbelievable act of selfishness, but you even want to disguise it in such a way that they'll never know it was you. You are a real tzaddik. And keep it quiet. And why I tried, as I was running around the town, trying to get the right denominations, and I kept trying to squash him down. He kept speaking louder and louder. You got all this trouble? You're going to give away all the money that's for your own daughter's chasana? And you're going to make sure that every... And keep him quiet. And when I came to give over the money, he was speaking so loud, he was so uncontrollable, that I suddenly blurted out. I came out with an emergency plan, and I said, I want money. And that fixed him. Because I was put into such disgrace, and I had to go through such an undignified thing that completely, yes, and that's what happened, that's what I did. Now, if you're thinking, I'm sure you're racing ahead of me, when I heard that story, I turned to my brother-in-law, and the both of us had the same question. We both looked at each other and we said, what did we say? Anything that's going to make that voice speak loud, boy, it's that, isn't it? Isn't it? Not only are you going to give your own daughter's money, not only are you going to do it in such a way that they won't know it's you, but you're even prepared to go through disgrace in order to quiet your own pride? Well, you're the tzaddik of the world. Huh? You hear that? So we raced over through the crowd, and we went up to Rav Shalom, and we said to him, I mean, we were just beginners, we didn't know. We said, Shalom, but listen, that story's got a flaw. Because doing a thing like that, surely that's going to swell his pride, isn't it? So Rav Shalom looked at us and said, you don't understand. Going through this grace, you can't feel proud. You hear that? Try it. When you're going through this grace, you try and feel, yeah, while you're being hounded out of town, in people's eyes, you are dirt. You try at that time to let that little boy smell himself. He doesn't smell at all. Hear that? Beautiful. Beautiful idea. Beautiful. But what it means? It means that the legacy of this movement was people who did that. People seriously reached levels of unselfishness where they put themselves through these experiences and they worked on themselves in these ways. Let me see if there's a story I forgot to tell you. What do we have? We have here a movement, okay, that every Jew should know about. It's possible that this should be the beginning of our work, especially Sfiras HaOmer, where you count the days. I mean, the mitzvah of counting the days is the mitzvah, but the work inwardly that a person should be doing while he counts those steps, a person should be going through the 49 degrees, a person should work through the 7 times 7 subsections of each section of character building. You want a program for it? You can look even in a siddur. Even in Ashkenazi siddurim, they have the Kabbalistic names next to the days. So you can work out what it is you should do. You don't find that easy enough? You can look in Pirkei Avos. In the 6th chapter of Pirkei Avos, you have there 48 ways, what are called the 48 ways to acquire Torah. 48 means one for each day. There's no question they go in order. Each one for a different day, you can easily well translate in English, you can commentary, is a 48 plan, 48 stage program or plan of self-development that a person can do. By the way, why it's not 49 is because the 49th day, of course, is revision of all the others. Always the one next to last is a total summing up and a revision that strengthens all the others. The 7th of each, of course, is a revision of those 7, and the 49th is a revision of all 7 times 7. Actually, the 48 stated there, the 49th is not stated because it has already been stated. It's all 48 together. That is what we should be doing now. A person should study it, you take Pirkei Avos, you should study it, you go out into the streets. If you're a woman, stay home. And there you should be working on yourself in such a way that you refine these details, you put them into practice, you work for a week on this particular midah until you become proficient at it, you work for a week on the next, you study Masilis Shorin, you study these books, you study it in partnerships, in chavrusas, you arrange shirim in it, and that's the legacy that we've been left. You should study as well as the Muslim material, the great personalities of Musa, because it's a tremendous way to be inspired by these things. You study the Talmidim of Israel. He had a number of students who put his message into the world and brought it down to our generation. You study their personalities, their life stories, the way they were imbued and inspired by their Rebbe, what they taught over, the unbelievable greatness that they reached. You read the Torah that they wrote, put into the world. And it's a shame if we're able to do this correctly, the result would be that we could get through 49 stages and Yitzh Hashem get to that 50th level, which is the level of complete transcendence. That level, which is a total different world, a shuas where we receive Torah in a transcendent plane in such a way that not only do we receive the body of it and its outer structure, but its effect on the personality as well.